We were greatly impressed by the skill with which the Tibetans handled their chopsticks, and our astonishment was great to see them picking up individual grains of rice with them. Mutual wonder helped to create a friendly atmosphere, and there was much hearty laughter. At the end of the meal, beer was served and added to the cheerfulness of the gathering. I noticed that the monks did not drink it. Gradually the talk veered toward our problems, and we heard that the authorities had decided to send a letter to the central government in Lhasa, communicating our request for permission to stay in Tibet. We were told to compose a petition in the English language, which the two officials desired to forward with their letter. This we did on the spot, and our petition was in our presence affixed to the official letter, which had already been prepared. This was sealed with due ceremony and handed to a courier, who immediately started for Lhasa. We could scarcely realize the fact of our friendly reception and that we should be allowed to stay in Tredon until an answer arrived from Lhasa. Our experience with junior officials had not been satisfactory, so we asked for written confirmation of the verbal consent to our residence in Tredon. This we obtained. At length we returned to our quarters, happy that things had gone so well. We had hardly arrived when the door was opened, and a regular procession of heavily laden servants trooped in. They brought us sacks of flour, rice, and sampo as well as four slaughtered sheep. We did not know from whom the gifts had come until the mayor, who had accompanied the servants, explained to us that the two high officials had sent them. When we tried to thank him, the mayor modestly disclaimed all credit, and no one seemed willing to admit the generous action. As we parted, the easygoing Tibetan said something that was to serve me in good stead. The haste of Europeans has no place in Tibet. We must learn patience if we wish to arrive at the goal. As we three sat alone in our house looking at all the gifts, we could hardly believe in our change of luck. Our request for permission to reside in Tibet was on its way to Lhasa, and we had now enough supplies to last us for months. For shelter we had a thick roof instead of a flimsy tent, and a woman servant, alas, neither young nor beautiful, to light the fire and fetch water. We regretted that we possessed nothing of worth which we might have sent to the Bonpo in token of our gratitude. We had nothing but a little medicine to offer him, but we hoped for an occasion to express our thanks in due form. As in Gartok, we had here had occasion to encounter the courtesy of the nobles of Lhasa, in praise of which I had read so much in Sir Charles Bell's books. As we were to stay for months here, we made plans for passing the time. We must without fail make expeditions in the Annapurna and Halagiri regions and in plains to the north. But, a little later, the abbot, whose assistance the mayor had tried to enlist on our behalf, came to see us. He told us that our stay in Tredon had been approved only on the condition that we must never go further away from the town than one day's march. We could go on excursions wherever we liked, provided we were back before night. If we did not comply with these instructions, he would have to report to Lhasa, and that would no doubt prejudice our whole case. The village consisted of about 20 houses dominated by the hill on which the monastery stood. It housed only 7 monks. The village houses were narrow and crowded together, but, nevertheless, every house had its own courtyard, in which wares were stored. All the inhabitants of the village were in some way connected with trade or transport. The real nomads lived scattered over the plain. We had occasion to attend several religious festivals, the most impressive of which was the Harvest Thanksgiving. We were now on a friendly footing with all the inhabitants and used to doctor them, being particularly successful in our treatment of wounds and colic. The monotony of life in Tredon was varied now and again by the visits of high functionaries, and I have a vivid recollection of the arrival of the second Garpan on his way to Gartok. Long before there was any sign of his convoy, soldiers arrived to announce his coming. Then came his cook, who at once began to prepare his food. And it was only the next day that the Garpan himself arrived with his caravan and retinue of 30 servants. The whole population, including ourselves, crowded to see him coming. The great man and his family rode on splendid mules, and the elders of the village each conducted a member of the family, holding his animal's bridle, to the quarters prepared for them. We were less impressed by the garpent than by his daughter. She was the first Swan Ye young woman we had seen since 1939, and we found her very pretty. Her clothes were of pure silk and her nails lacquered red. Perhaps she had slightly overdone the rouge, powder, and lipstick, but she exhaled freshness and cleanliness. We asked her if she was the prettiest girl in Lhasa, but she modestly said no, and declared that there were many far prettier girls in the capital. We were very sorry to lose her charming company when the party moved on the next day. We had a new guest in Tradun soon after, a state official from Nepal who came to see us but posed as a pilgrim. We felt that he wished to persuade us to go to Nepal against our wishes. He said we should be well received in Kathmandu, the capital, and find occupation there. Our journey would be organized by the administration and 300 rupees already had been allocated for our expenses. That all sounded very attractive, perhaps too attractive, for we knew how great was British influence in Asia. We did not take his advice. After months we began to lose patience and to get on each other's nerves. Cop kept on saying that he would gladly accept the invitation to go to Nepal. Orf Snater as usual went his own way. He bought 4 sheep as pack animals and wanted to go to Chengthang. It is true that this was contrary to our original decision to await the letter from Lhasa, but we greatly doubted getting a favorable answer. Orf Snater, losing patience, marched out one afternoon with his loaded sheep and pitched his camp a few miles away from Tradun. We helped him to carry his things there and intended to visit him the next day. Cop also began to pack and the local authorities promised to give him transport. They were very pleased that he had decided to go to Nepal, but they disapproved of Orf Snater's behavior. From that day on, guards slept in front of our door. But the next day, to our surprise, Orf Snater came back to us with his baggage. His sheep had been attacked by wolves, which had eaten 2 of them. This compelled him to return. And so we 3 spent one more evening together. On the following morning, Cop bade us farewell. The whole population collected to see him off. So now, out of the 7 of us who had broken out of the internment camp, 5 of whom had made for Tibet, only Orf Snater and I remained. We were the only mountaineers in the group, and consequently physically and mentally best fitted for the lonely and strenuous life in this bleak land. It was now late November, and the caravan routes were no longer much frequented. The monastic official sent us some sheep and 12 loads of yak's dung for fuel, and we needed it, for the temperature was already 12 degrees centigrade. The village of happiness. In spite of the wintry weather, we were more than ever determined to leave Tradun, with or without a letter of authorization. We started hoarding provisions and bought a second yak. But just in the middle of our preparations, the abbot arrived with the news that the long-awaited letter had come from Lhasa. What we had secretly feared had come true. We were forbidden to travel into Inner Tibet. The letter was not handed to us personally. We were merely told that we must go by the shortest route to Nepal, but that we might march in Tibetan territory as far as Kurong. From there it was only 8 miles to the Nepalese frontier and 7 days' march to the capital, Kathmandu. We would be given transport and servants for the journey. We agreed at once to this ruling, as our route would take us somewhat further into Tibet, and the longer we remained on the right side of the law the better. On December 17, we left Tradun, which had sheltered us for 4 months. We felt no grudge against the Tibetans for not allowing us to go to Lhasa. Everyone knows how hard it is for foreigners without passports to get a footing in any country. By giving us presents and providing us with transport, the Tibetans had shown hospitality far exceeding that customary in other countries. Although I did not then appreciate our good fortune so much as I do now, Orf Snater and I were still thankful for the 8 months we had passed outside the barbed wire. Now we were on the march again. Our convoy consisted of Orf Snater and myself, accompanied by 2 servants. One of these carried, wrapped up like a sacred relic, the letter of the government to the district officer at Kurong. We were all mounted, and our 2 yaks were kept moving by a driver. One could see from far off that our caravan belonged to persons of consequence, very different from the three down-at-heel vagabonds who had crossed the Himalayas into Tibet some months before. Our road took us again over the Himalayan watershed toward the southeast. The Tsangpo was already frozen when we crossed it, and the nights in the tent were bitterly cold. After riding for a week, we reached Dzongka, which was visible from a long way off by reason of a thick cloud of smoke which hung over the houses. Dzongka really deserved to be called a village. It contained about 100 mud brick houses grouped about a monastery, and around the village were cultivated fields. The village was situated at the junction of two streams that form the river Kosi and, penetrating the Himalayas, flow into Nepal. The place was enclosed by a 30-foot rampart and commanded by a splendid peak, some 20,000 feet high, called by the natives Chogulhari. It was Christmas Day when we came into Dzongka, our first Christmas since we had escaped. We were lodged in surprisingly comfortable quarters. The tree line was only 2 days away, and wood was no longer an expensive luxury, it could be used for building and for all household needs. A contraption of tin built around the stove in which we burned crackling juniper wood warmed the whole room very agreeably. When evening came we lit some Tibetan butter lamps, and to celebrate the day we soon had a leg of mutton stewing in our cooking pot. As in every other place in Tibet, there were no public inns here. Billets in private houses are assigned to travelers by the authorities. This is done by rotation, so that the population is not too badly inconvenienced, and the arrangement forms part of the taxation system. We had not planned to stay here long, but we were kept in Dzongka a whole month by heavy snowfalls. All day thick snowflakes fell and communications were interrupted. We were glad of our rest here, and interested ourselves in some of the activities of the monks and enjoyed as spectators the performances of a group of dancers from Nyanam. A number of aristocratic officials lived here, and we soon made friends with them. By now we spoke good Tibetan and carried on long conversations through which we got to know much about the manners and customs of the country. Saint Sylvester's Eve passed uncelebrated, but our thoughts dwelt more than ever on home. Whenever we could, during this period of waiting, we made short expeditions in the neighborhood and found many sandstone caves, a mine of interest to us, containing as they did idols of wood or clay and leaves from Tibetan sacred books, offerings no doubt to the saints who used to live in these caverns. On January 19th, the roads were sufficiently passable to allow us to start off in company with a huge yak caravan. Ahead of us went a herd of yaks, carrying no loads, which acted as snowplows and seemed to enjoy the exercise very much. The country was intersected by valleys and ravines, and in the first 2 days we crossed no fewer than 12 bridges over the Kosi. My yak, which came from Chenghang, was unused to bridges and jibed vigorously when he had to cross one. It was only by pushing behind and pulling in front, an operation in which the drivers enthusiastically assisted us, that we could get him across. I had already been warned not to bring him to Kirong as he would not be able to stand the hot summer climate, but I had not wanted to leave him behind in view of our plans for flight, which we had not abandoned. Throughout all this time my thermometer showed an unvarying temperature of 30 degrees centigrade. There were no lower markings on the instrument. We were deeply impressed by a rock monastery in the neighborhood of the village of Longda. 700 feet above the valley, red temples and countless cells were perched like birds' nests on the rocks. Despite the danger of avalanches, Orf's nature and I could not refrain from climbing the rock face, and so obtained another wonderful view of the Himalayas. We also met some monks and nuns and learned from them that this was the monastery founded by Milarepa, the famous Tibetan saint and poet, who lived in the 11th century. We could easily understand that the glorious surroundings and the loneliness of the place were peculiarly adapted to meditation and the making of poetry. We left this place regretfully and determined to revisit it one day. Every day we found less snow and after reaching the tree line soon found ourselves in a really tropical region. In this atmosphere the winter garments given us by the Tibetan government were too warm for us. Now we came to Drothang, the last stopping place before Kirong. I remember that all the inhabitants of this place had highly developed goiters, which one rarely sees in Tibet. We took a week to get to Kirong, which when the road is good is only 3 days' march from Dzongka, and can be reached in a single day by a fast courier. The name Kirong means the village of happiness, and it really deserves the name. I shall never cease thinking of this place with yearning, and if I can choose where to pass the evening of my life, it will be in Kirong. There I would build myself a house of red cedar wood and have one of the rushing mountain streams running through my garden, in which every kind of fruit would grow, for though its altitude is over 9,000 feet, Kirong lies on the 28th parallel. When we arrived in January the temperature was just below freezing. It seldom falls below 10 degrees centigrade. The seasons correspond to what we have in the Alps, but the vegetation is subtropical. One can go skiing the whole year round, and in the summer there is a row of 20,000 footers to climb. There are about 80 houses in the village, which is the seat of two district governors who administer 30 villages. We were told that we were the first Europeans who had ever come to Kirong, and the inhabitants watched our entry with astonishment. This time we were quartered in the house of a farmer, which reminded me of our Tyrolese houses. As a matter of fact, the whole of the village might have been transplanted from the Alps, except that instead of chimneys the roofs of the houses were decorated with prayer flags. These were always in the five colors which represented different aspects of life in Tibet. On the ground floor were the stables for cows and horses. They were separated by a thick ceiling from the living rooms of the family, which are approached by a ladder from the courtyard. Thick stuffed mattresses served as beds and easy chairs, and near them were small, low tables. The members of the household kept their clothes in brightly painted wardrobes, and before the inevitable carved wooden altar, butter lamps were burning. In winter the whole family sit on the deal floor boards around a huge open log fire and sip their tea. The room in which Ofsnater and I were put was rather small, so I soon shifted to the hay barn next door. Ofsnater carried on our unceasing struggle with rats and bugs, while I had to cope with mice and fleas. I never got the better of the vermin, but the view over glaciers and rhododendron forests made up for my discomfort. We had a servant allotted to us, but preferred to do our cooking ourselves. We had a fireplace in our room and were given wood to burn. We spent very little money, our provisions did not cost us more than £2 a month each. I had a pair of trousers made, and the tailor charged half a crown. The staple food in this region is tsampa. This is how they prepare it. You heat sand to a high temperature in an iron pan and then pour barley corns onto it. They burst with a slight pop, whereupon you put the corns and the sand in a fine meshed sieve through which the sand runs. After this you grind the corn very small. The resulting meal is stirred up into a paste with butter, tea or milk or beer, and then eaten. The Tibetans make a special cult of tsampa and have many ways of preparing it. We soon got accustomed to it, but never cared much for butter tea, which is usually made with rancid butter and is generally repugnant to Europeans. It is, however, universally drunk and appreciated by the Tibetans, who often drink as many as 60 cups in a day. The Tibetans of Kirong, besides butter tea and tsampa, eat rice, buckwheat, maize, potatoes, turnips, onions, beans, and radishes. Meat is a rarity, for as Kirong is a particularly holy place, no animal is ever slaughtered there. Meat appeared on the table only when it had been brought in from another district or, more often, when bears or panthers left part of their prey uneaten. I never understood how this doctrine could be reconciled with the fact that every autumn some 15,000 sheep are driven through Kirong bound for the slaughterhouses in Nepal and that the Tibetans levy export duty on them. At the very beginning of our stay we paid a call on the district authorities. Our travel document had already been delivered by a servant and the Bonpo thought that we would go straight on into Nepal. That was by no means our intention, and we told him that we would like to stay for a while at Kirong. He took this very calmly and promised, at our request, to report to Lhasa. We also visited the representative of Nepal, who described his country in the most attractive terms. We had meanwhile learned that Kop, after staying a few days in the capital, had been pushed off to an internment camp in India. The seductions of automobiles, bicycles, and moving pictures which, we were told, we should find in Kathmandu, made no appeal to us. We could not really hope to get a residence permit from Lhasa, and if we went to Nepal we expected to be expelled into India. Accordingly, we decided to recruit our strength in this fairy-like village and stay there till we had worked out a new plan of escape. We could not foresee then that we would stay nearly 9 months in Kurong. We were not in the least bored. We filled exercise books with notes on the manners and customs of the Tibetans. On most days we went out to explore the neighborhood. Orff Schnatter, who had been secretary of the Himalaya Institute in Munich, used his opportunities for map-making. There were only 3 names on the map of the region we had brought with us, but we now filled in more than 200. In fact, we not only enjoyed our freedom but made practical use of it. Our excursions, which at first were limited to the immediate neighborhood, gradually extended further and further. The inhabitants were quite accustomed to us, and no one interfered with us. Of course it was the mountains that attracted us most, and after that the hot springs around Kurong. There were several of these, the hottest of which was in a bamboo forest on the bank of the ice-cold River Kosi. The water bubbled out of the grounds nearly at boiling point and was led into an artificial basin, where it still had a temperature of about 40 degrees centigrade. I used to plunge alternately into the hot pool and into the glacial waters of the Kosi. In the spring there is a regular bathing season in this place. Swarms of Tibetans came along and bamboo huts sprang up everywhere in this usually lonely spot, 2 hours distant from Kurong. Men and women tumbled naked into the pool, and any signs of prudishness provoked roars of laughter. Many families pay holiday visits to this spa. They set out from their homes, with sacks full of provisions and barrels of beer, and settle down for a fortnight in bamboo huts. The upper classes also are accustomed to visit the springs and arrive with caravans and a staff of servants. But the whole holiday season lasts only a short time as the river, swollen with melting snow, overflows the springs. In Kurong I made the acquaintance of a monk who had studied in the school of medicine in Lhasa. He was much respected and was able to live richly on the provisions that he received as fees for his services. His methods of treatment were diverse. One of them was to press a prayer stamp on the spot affected, which seemed to succeed with hysterical patients. In bad cases he branded the patient with a hot iron. I can bear witness to the fact that he thus restored a seemingly hopeless case to consciousness, but this treatment affected many of his patients adversely. He also employed this drastic treatment on domestic animals. As I was reckoned a sort of half-doctor and am greatly interested in everything connected with medicine, I used to have long conversations with this monk. He confessed to me that his knowledge was limited, but he did not worry himself unduly about that and managed to avoid unpleasant incidents by frequently changing his place of residence. His conscience was relieved by the fact that the fees derived from his dubious cures served to finance his pilgrimages. In the middle of February, we had our first Tibetan New Year. The year is reckoned by the lunar calendar and has 2 names, one of an animal and the other of an element. The New Year festival is, after the birth and death days of Buddha, the greatest event of the year. During the previous night we already heard the voices of singing beggars and wandering monks going from house to house in quest of alms. In the morning fresh-cut pine trees decked out with flags were stuck on the roofs, religious texts were solemnly recited, and tsampu offered to the gods. The people bring an offering of butter to the temples, and soon the huge copper cauldrons are overflowing. Only then are the gods propitiated and ready to grant favors in the new year. White silk veils are draped around the gilded statues as a special mark of respect, and the worshippers reverently lay their foreheads against them. Rich or poor, all come full of devotion and with no inner misgivings to lay their offerings before the gods and to pray for their blessing. Is there any people so uniformly attached to their religion and so obedient to it in their daily life? I have always envied the Tibetans their simple faith, for all my life I have been a seeker. Though I learned, while in Asia, The way to meditate, the final answer to the riddle of life has not been vouchsafed to me. But I have at least learned to contemplate the events of life with tranquility and not let myself be flung to and fro by circumstances in a sea of doubt. The people did not pray only at the turn of the year. For 7 days they danced, sang, and drank under the benevolent eyes of the monks. In every house there was a party, and we, too, were invited. It is sad to remember that the festal celebrations in our house were overclouded by a tragedy. One day I was called into the room of our hostess's younger sister. The room was dark, and only when hot hands gripped mine did I realize that I was standing near her. When my eyes had got accustomed to the darkness, I looked toward the bed and recoiled in a horror that I could hardly conceal. The lay completely transformed by sickness, one who 2 days before had been a pretty, healthy girl. Though a layman, I instantly saw that she had smallpox. Her larynx and tongue were already attacked, and she could only cry out with thick articulation that she was dying. I tried to tell her that it was not so, and then escaped from the room as quickly as possible to have a thorough washing. There was nothing to be done, and one could only hope that an epidemic would not break out. Orfsnater also visited her and agreed with my diagnosis. 2 days later she died. So after the joys of the festival, this mournful event made us acquainted with the ceremonies of a Tibetan burial. The decorated pine tree that stood on the roof was removed, and the next day at dawn the body was wrapped in white grave cloths and borne out of the house on the back of a professional corpse carrier. We followed the group of mourners, who consisted of 3 men only. Near the village, on a high place recognizable from afar as a place of burial by the multitude of vultures and crows which hovered over it, one of the men hacked the body to pieces with an axe. A second sat nearby, murmuring prayers and beating on a small drum. The third man scared the birds away and at intervals handed the other 2 men beer or tea to cheer them up. The bones of the dead girl were broken to pieces, so that they too could be consumed by the birds and no trace of the body should remain. Barbaric as all this seems, the ceremony draws its origin from deep religious motives. The Tibetans wish to leave no trace after death of their bodies, which, without souls, have no significance. The bodies of nobles and high-ranking lamas are burned, but among the people the usual way of dealing with them is by dismemberment, and only the bodies of very poor people, for whom this form of disposal is too costly, are thrown into the river. Here the fishes perform the function of the vultures. When poor people die of contagious diseases, they are disposed of by special persons paid by the government. Fortunately, the cases of smallpox were few, and only a small number died. In our house there was mourning for 49 days, and then a fresh tree with prayer flags was hoisted onto the roof. At this ceremony appeared many monks who said prayers to the accompaniment of their own peculiar music. All this naturally costs money, and when deaths occur in the family the Tibetans usually sell some of their jewelry or the possessions of the defunct, the proceeds of which pay for the obsequies performed by the monks and the oil used in their countless little lamps. During all this time, we continued our daily walks, and the excellent snow gave us the idea of making skis. Orfsnater got hold of a couple of birch trunks which we stripped of their bark and dried before the fire in our room. I started making sticks and straps, and with the aid of a carpenter we succeeded in producing 2 pairs of decent-looking skis. We were delighted with their workmanlike appearance and looked forward to trying them with great excitement. Then, like lightning from a clear sky, came an order from the Bonpo forbidding us to leave Kirong except for walks in the immediate neighborhood. We protested energetically, but were told that Germany was a powerful state and that if anything happened to us in the mountains, complaints would be made in Lhasa and the authorities in Kirong held responsible. The Bonpo remained unshaken by our protestations and did his best to convince us that in the mountains we should be in great danger of attacks by bears, leopards, and wild dogs. We knew that their anxiety about our safety was all humbug, but conjectured that they had adopted their attitude in deference to the requests of the superstitious population, who possibly believed that our visits to the mountains might make the gods angry. For the moment we could do nothing but submit. During the next few weeks, we obeyed orders, but then we could not resist the temptation to go skiing. The attraction of the snow and the ice slopes was too much for us, and one day we had recourse to a stratagem. I took up my quarters provisionally by one of the hot springs only half an hour distant from the village.